It's Wildlife Wednesday. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we invite you to our conversation. If you've got questions about wildlife where you are, if perhaps you've caught them on camera and would like to ask what you've seen, or you'd like a question about the behavior that you've been seen acting up around your area, you are welcome to join our conversation today with David Drake by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. If you've got a picture or a question, you can always send an email to talk@wpr.org. David Drake is a UW Extension Wildlife Specialist and Professor with the Division of Extension and the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology on the UW-Madison campus, where he recently came from. It was Russell Labs, right?
That's right.
David, welcome back.
Well, nice to be back, Lee. Thank you.
So I wanted to start today with a question that we get often on this show, and that is about pine marten sightings.
Oh, yeah.
Otherwise known as the American marten.
Yes.
The DNR classifies it as a weasel, but it doesn't, like, it's in the weasel family, yeah, but not the weasel genus?
Well, so it's in the Mustelidae family.
Mustelidae family.
Mustelids are weasels.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have 8 weasel species in Wisconsin. We have three true weasels, and that would be the smallest carnivore we've got is the least weasel.
The least weasel.
Then we've got a short-tailed weasel, and then we've got a long-tailed weasel. And those three weasels are the ones that turn white in the winter and then turn brown in the summer. And the short-tailed and long-tailed weasels have black tip to their tails. The least weasel does not. And then, so those are the three true weasels.
Uh-huh.
And then we've got the other 5 weasels, or the other 5 species in the Mustelids, in the Mustelidae family, would be the badger, the pine marten,
uh-huh,
the fisher, the otter, and the, oh, shoot. There's 8 of them. And the, what's the other one? It's, skunks used to be in there, but they have now been reclassified into their own grouping.
I saw the same thing with minks, too, right?
Mink is the 8th one, yes.
Because mink used to be in the weasel genus, Mustela, and then I think that got switched out.
But now they're in the 8th weasel-like animal we have in the state of Wisconsin. So, and of those, the pine marten, or the American marten, is probably the least common, simply because it's not, the population is not as healthy as the other 7 species that are in that Mustelidae family or in the weasel family.
Were they reintroduced to us?
They were, yep.
Because
yep,
they got pretty much wiped out,
they
right?
They did. Yep, they sure did. And so they've been reintroduced, and they are found primarily in the northern part of the state. So they, along with fishers, are in the northern part of the state primarily, and they are associated primarily with old growth climax stage forests. And so that's what we have up in the northern part of the state. They use cavities in trees. They eat things like chipmunks and redback voles and mice and things like that. And the martens are not doing so well. They still are kind of struggling for, you know, the population is not going extinct by any stretch of the imagination, but they're not growing necessarily.
What's the challenge for them?
It's a lot of predation by fishers, for one of it. And so, yes, and fishers were also reintroduced.
They are carnivorous,
fishers,
right?
Are doing quite well.
Yeah.
And fishers, as a matter of fact, are starting to expand. Occasionally, they'll make runs down into the southern Wisconsin, along the Mississippi River Valley, for example. They're seen over in around the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and things like that. So the fishers are doing quite well. The martens are not doing as well as was hoped, but there's a continual amount of research going on to try to, you know, sustain that population, and hopefully they will.
David, is that because the fishers are larger than the pine martens? Do they just outsize them?
Yep, the fishers are larger for sure, so that's part of it. And then, you know, fishers just seem to be like they've adapted better. They've kind of taken hold of that habitat, that environment, and seem to do a better job of kind of just living.
I remember when folks have called saying they've seen a pine marten in the past, that you were a little skeptical, or maybe probably it was something else other than a pine marten. Pine Marten to me is the bib, I think. Like, I think of the bib. I look for the bib on a Pine Marten.
Yep.
But how do you differentiate between these weasels of Wisconsin?
Yeah, so, I mean, size is one way, but size is relative. So if you only see one animal and you've never seen it before, you don't know what, you know, what is large, small, what's that? What the heck does that mean? Pine Martens typically are a little bit more of blonde animal. You're right, they do have that bib. Where they've got, they can have kind of a blaze orange bib or kind of a lighter bib, smaller than a fisher, for example, for sure. Fishers tend to be pretty much solid black, and they've got a very big bushy tail, and that bushy tail on a fisher is roughly the size of the actual the length of the body if you go from nose to butt.
Okay.
So then there's, but all these animals, all the weasels, they kind of are short-legged, long tubular-ish bodies, kind of a small skull that tends to be a little bit more of a triangular head, thick fur, and they kind of lope as they run, you know. So they think of about a ferret. They're related to a ferret, and think about what a ferret looks like and kind of how a ferret runs, and that's kind of what minks do and fishers and martens and the other
kind of snake along.
Yeah.
I mean their body helps them move.
Yeah, super cool animals. Primarily nocturnal. Most of the species are nocturnal, so you know they can be relatively common in Wisconsin. We just may not see them because they are relatively low to the ground. They kind of move quickly through vegetation or habitat at night, and so we have minks that are really common in Madison here, for example.
Really,
And minks are pretty common across the state.
Is that because they're nocturnal again? That I'm not seeing them.
Yeah, nocturnal, and you know they think about all the things that an animal like a mink would eat. So again, rats, mice, mm-hmm. chipmunks. I mean, mm-hmm. in the city, there's a bunch of those. A lot of good habitat for them. You know, they use kind of brushy areas. Going to be associated with wetlands that have some pretty good vegetation. We've got a decent amount of good mink habitat in Wisconsin, but in Madison in particular, and it certainly is not unique to Madison. Other cities in the state of Wisconsin would have minks in them as well.
So the urban minks are doing fine. The fishers are expanding.
Yeah.
Is there anything we can do for those sweet, cute little pine martens?
Well, you know, I mean, one thing, money always helps. So if you want to donate money to the DNR, that's one thing you could do because that money would go, and you could dedicate some of that money to pine marten research, I'm sure. You know, if you've got the ability and have enough habitat or enough acreage, especially up in the northern part of the state, if you can kind of look and see what pine martens need. So they big old growth timber, a lot of small mammals. So if you have on your forest floor, don't clean that forest floor, but have kind of what we call a dirty forest floor with what we call CWD, and this doesn't stand for chronic wasting disease. CWD in this instance stands for coarse woody debris. So leave a lot of dead rotting logs of different sizes, limbs, things like that, because that attracts the small mammals, and it will also attract the fishers, provides food base for the fishers. It also provides some cover for the fishers. So as they're on the ground, then they've got some protective cover and shelter from that coarse woody debris, in addition to being able to use those standing trees.
I think because they're so sleek and fast, I'd be hard-pressed to be able to identify or differentiate a mink from fisher from a pine marten and some of the other weasels of Wisconsin.
Yeah, well, so again, they all comes down to marks.
Markings.
So a mink has a white chin underneath, and you don't always see that, but they're kind of a blackish to a more of a sable-brown animal. They're smaller than a fisher for sure. The other thing you might see where you see mink is otters, and you're not going to confuse an otter and a mink because otters are so much larger and have that kind of, big, robust tail to them. And so, if you get into look at a pine marten, it's kind of a blondish animal, maybe, I don't know, the size of a smallish house cat, something like that. And if it's adhered to the side of a tree, and you're in northern Wisconsin, that's probably a pretty good indication you might be looking at a marten.
Do any of the other ones turn white like our weasels
do in
the winter?
Just the weasels, yeah.
All right.
Within the weasel family. Now we've got snowshoe hares, for example, which turn white, but obviously they're not in the weasel family. So we do have a couple other animals that will turn white. But for the weasels, it's only those three, the least short-haired and long-tailed weasel.
How are our otters doing? You brought up otters, and I am kind of curious. I would like to see more of them, but maybe in south central Wisconsin, that's not their best place to be. I would imagine on the northern lakes, you would be more likely to see them.
Well, we have otters down here, so you can see them in the lakes of Madison occasionally. And, you know, if you're a good time to see them a lot of times is in the wintertime if there's a lead in the water. So if you've got some ice along a river, but then there's a patch of open water, a lot of times they'll be there where they might be out on the ice eating a fish that they caught or just basking in the sun. Look for otter slides. It's not what you would think at a child's playground, but it's a muddy slide down the embankment into the water. And I think a lot of people equate otters with being playful animals, and they certainly are. They'll have a really fun time sliding down that muddy embankment and just kind of splashing around the water and then going to town as a predator. And they are a very efficient, very successful predator.
Well, when they're looking for open water in the winter, does that make winter in south central or southern Wisconsin more amenable to the otter than northern Wisconsin?
Yeah, maybe. But they can still find, even up in northern Wisconsin sometimes, if you've got running water along rivers, maybe the edge of that water. Where the edge of the water is, the ice isn't as thick, or there might be a little bit of open water they can slide in and out of. But they're statewide, and again, super cool animals. They're just because they're kind of secretive and can be somewhat nocturnal, you may not always see them.
I wish they were more social for my personal enjoyment.
They are so cool. They are the best.
David Drake, our guest, UW Extension Wildlife Specialist, and you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email talk at WPR.org. Let's go to Tom in Oconto. Tom, hi.
Hi. Referring to the weasels, you didn't mention anything about sexual dimorphism.
Oh,
yeah.
The weasels are much larger than female weasels. So when you have a long tail and you have a short tail, the female long tail weasel is almost identical to the male short tail weasel.
Yep.
The only difference is the length of the tail.
Yep.
Tom, you can tell the difference. I would be hard-pressed. Sexual dimorphism.
Well, Tom may or may not be able to tell the difference. And Tom, I don't mean to throw you under the bus there, but here's the deal. As Tom is absolutely right, there's sexual dimorphism. So, and this is not unique to the weasel family. Most species of wildlife, the males are bigger than the females. You do have reverse sexual dimorphism in raptors, for example. So in raptors like hawks, that the female is larger than the male. So if you see a pair of red-tailed hawks and one looks bigger than the other, generally that's a female, that's the bigger one. But generally for most of the species, that males are larger than females, so that's the sexual dimorphism. And that is absolutely true with, you could have a female long-tailed weasel that is the same size as a male short-tailed weasel, and you may not necessarily be able to tell the two of them apart, especially if they're in brushy areas, because you may not be able to see the entire tail. Mm-hmm. And so that is absolutely true. The other cool thing about a lot of the weasels, and if we're going to get into the sex, I mean, I didn't know we were going to do this before noon, but okay, is that they will have delayed implantation. So after the egg gets fertilized, it may not actually get embedded in the uterine wall right away. Mm-hmm. And so they will wait sometimes to actually embed that fertilized egg in the uterine wall, and then implant it at a later date when the conditions for having the young are more favorable.
Oh.
And so it's super cool that they can do all that.
So they delayed
implantation.
They're waiting for the prime moment to be able to give birth.
Yep.
And if I'm not when I was reading up on the pine martin, David, I saw that, they're in those little kits are in the burrows for like weeks, if not a month and a half, 2 months.
Yeah. Yeah, they can be. I mean, especially in cavities, because the cavity is providing warmth, that's providing cover and protection for them, and it allows the mom and to not have to dump a ton of resources into those young in a really short period of time, because that also takes it taxes the mom's physiology and her her calories and things like that. So if you can have kind of slow growth, and this is true for mammals, especially larger mammals, is you have typically smaller litter sizes or fewer young. And then they dump a bunch of resources into those, you know, one or two or three young.
Try to make sure they all survive.
Yeah, and then you have a longer gestation period. The longer, the bigger you are as an animal, the longer the weaning period is, the bigger you are as an animal and things like that. And so nature's got this figured out.
We're still trying.
We are still trying to catch up, but nature is two steps ahead of us. Yes.
We're still guessing to some degree. Tom, thank you very much, and happy to talk about sexual dimorphism before noon, because it's part of the story of the survival of some of these animals. So thank you very much. Let's go to Randall in Sturgeon Bay next. Randall, hi.
Hello, can you hear me?
Loud and clear.
Excellent. I learned just yesterday that a local creek here has such a high E. coli count right now that the raccoon population is getting sick from it. And so my question is, how frequently does this sort of thing happen to wildlife?
Oh, talk about survival, Randall.
Yeah.
E. coli in the waterways and what that means for our wildlife.
Yeah,
David.
That's a really good question. I don't know how often this happens. And again, it depends on probably that E. coli, if it's human-sourced or wildlife-sourced. Mm. You know, I don't have data to support this, but my assumption or contention is that, you know, especially on these lakes where you have a lot of septic systems, there's probably a lot of leaky septic systems.
Old septic systems. Yes.
And so that allows that human waste to go into the water body. And you can have E. coli outbreaks because of that. There is some thought that in places where you have high densities of Canada geese, for example, especially on small lakes may not have flowage to it, so where the lake is closed, that there could be a higher count of E. coli in some of those water bodies because of the defecation from the Canada geese. So it does occur, for sure. And I don't know, I'm not familiar with the specific story that the caller was talking about with raccoons and E. coli, not to doubt that. But a lot of things do also kill raccoons. So when they're susceptible to parvovirus, for example. And so when we have outbreaks of parvo, you'll see some die-off of raccoons occasionally. And raccoons, you know, they eat a whole bunch of different stuff, and they're just kind of a walking disease to start with. So there's a lot of things that may get them. But it wouldn't surprise me that E. coli, if that is what actually is being tied to the death of some of these raccoons, that it wouldn't surprise me if that was the case.
But it wouldn't just be raccoons then, would it?
It could be
case?
Other things, yeah. It could be other things as well. But it probably depends on how those animals are contacting the water. So raccoons, as we talked about last month, you know, that they go to the water and they're eating a lot of food out of the water. So aquatic invertebrates, they're eating crayfish, they might eat frogs, they might eat fish if they can catch them, things like that. So other animals that are having a lot of direct access to the water, they also may be susceptible to that E. coli outbreak. But if you're just floating on the water as a duck, for example, and you're not ingesting that water or taking a lot of that into your body, then maybe they wouldn't be as susceptible.
Randall, I suppose it's good advice to check your septic tanks wherever you are, especially if you've got a summer cabin that uses one and you don't think about it often, and you enjoy the waters as much as everybody does. Might be time to check your septic and make sure it's safe. For
and
everyone.
I'm not saying that that's exactly what's happening,
but it could be
one of the things it could be, yeah, for sure.
Randall, thank you so much for the call. Phil in Middleton, you're next. Hi, Phil.
Hey, how you doing? I have chickens now in my backyard. I used to have ducks, and we had some flooding back in 2018, I think, that displaced some of the weasels from my local Tiedemann's pond, and it expanded their geographical area, and the weasels killed several of my ducks, and I was really surprised at that.
Yeah. Well, the ducks should have handled the flooding. They didn't handle the weasels so well. Good news, bad news. Yeah, so weasels and mink, we get this sometimes occasionally with some of the larger weasels, like a long-tailed weasel, but mink in particular, they will surplus kill, or what's called surplus kill. So they will go into...
That's slaughter.
Essentially. So they will go into, especially if you have penned animals like ducks or chickens, and they will kill as many of them as they can, and sometimes they'll kill all of them. And a lot of times that they will catch their prey behind the neck, on the backside of the neck. And so that's, and then they'll kind of pinch down with their very sharp teeth. And a lot of times they will sever the spinal cord. And occasionally, depending on the size of the prey they're eating and the size of the animal, the size of the mink or weasel, that they can actually decapitate their prey. And so sometimes what you'll find is a bunch of dead chickens or dead ducks that, you know, their heads may be removed from their body. But you might find a lot of different animals, a lot of animals that are dead. And then they're just there. The bodies are there, but they're dead. And that is a lot of times an indication that some kind of a mink or a weasel has come along and probably surplus killed. And then they take what they need for that particular feeding with the idea that they would come back for additional feedings.
We'll be back.
We'll be back. That's right.
Is there anything Phil could have done to he's got chickens with the next flood? What can they do to protect against weasels?
Well, and it's not just weasels. So for backyard chickens, ducks, whatever you have. Yeah. I mean, it could be raccoons, fox, weasels, mink. It could be hawks, owls. It could be a pet domestic cat that got out. It could be a dog. So the best thing to do is to make sure that all of your animals are behind fencing and it is locked down so that things can't get under the fence. They can't dig under the fence. That the mesh size you're using on your fence is large or small enough, that nothing can get through the mesh size. A lot of these animals can climb, so make sure they can't climb up and into your pen. So make sure you've got good roofing on there, and the roof and the walls are secured together.
Can they jump? Because my raccoons get into my dumpster, and I still can't figure out how.
Yeah, well, they jump, but raccoons are also extremely good climbers.
Well,
they've got those opposable thumbs.
Baby hands.
They've got the baby hands, and they'll get a ladder if they need to, and so they're really resourceful and adaptable.
They'll get a ladder if they need to. I believe you.
That's right. Yeah. So. But the best thing to do is just make sure that whatever poultry you've got is secured behind really well done fencing.
Keep those chickens on lockdown, Phil. And I'm sorry about your ducks. Christy in Chippewa Falls, you're next. Hi, Christy.
Hi. Hey, thanks a lot. So at coffee this morning, the topic of possum came up, and so we're curious. Generally, is the possum population increasing, stable, doing well? What's the current range of possum in the state? With climate warming, is the population generally moving up like species, plants, animals, insects are doing?
I'm a possum fan, Christy, so I'm glad you asked, and I hope it's a happy answer, David.
It is. They're all happy answers, Lee. possums are awesome. They're awesome animals. I don't know the status of the overall possum population in Wisconsin, and I'm not sure anybody knows that because they're a non-game species. I mean, they're not a species that people
particularly... We're not tracking
them. We don't trap them. We don't harvest them generally, so we don't really have a good sense about how many there are. With that being said, I'm assuming that that population is very healthy because you see them quite often. You see them on the side of the road, dead, getting hit by cars.
And you're saying that's a good indicator, even though it's a bad thing.
Yeah, even though it's a bad thing, it's a good indicator if you're starting to see them regularly, as roadkill, things like that. Really cool things about possums, a couple things. Number one, they're the only marsupial we have in North America. So they're related to kangaroos, wallabies, things like that, because they have a pouch, which is super cool. And then, so as an aside, if you're a Seinfeld fan, the pouch episode was one of the best ones ever. Okay, now that's one thing. The other thing about possums is they have the most teeth of any mammal species in Wisconsin. They've got 50 teeth. The last thing I'll mention, because I know we're on a break here in just a second, and we can maybe pick this up after the break, but is that possums are beyond their historic northern range up here in Wisconsin. And possums do not have fur on their ears or on their tails. So possums that have been in Wisconsin and lived through a number of winters, a lot of times they're active year-round. Uh-huh. They don't hibernate through the winter. But what will happen is when we get really cold stretches, they will just kind of lay inside of a hollow log or under somebody's deck or whatever and just kind of wait out the cold stretch. But those bare ears and tail get frostbite a lot of times. And so you'll see possums, if they've been around for a number of years, that have chunked out ears or missing parts of their tail because that flesh has frozen and broken off. But possums are super cool. They're great to have around. They eat a lot of ticks. Really cool, really, really cool animals. They hang by their tail.
I love it because they're great parents. They seem to be wonderful with their kids, and they take them where they go. It always looks like a family vacation every time you see one.
It's like baby Bjorn. It's just baby Bjorn's built into the body.
Christy, thank you for giving us an opportunity to extol the virtues of possums. David Drake, our guest, UW Extension Wildlife Specialist, professor with the Division of Extension and the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology on the UW campus. Join us, 1-800-642-1234, or email talk@WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to WPR News. Well, we've been talking about Wisconsin's weasels on Wildlife Wednesday, and we want to invite you to the conversation. I'm Lee Rayburn, and our guest this hour is David Drake, UW Extension Wildlife Specialist, professor with the Division of Extension and the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology on the UW-Madison campus. Join us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email. And if you've got a picture, and we've got a few to get to here, you can send us a picture or a question to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. David, we've been talking about some of the things that have threatened Wisconsin's wildlife here, and I know the UW Urban Canid Project is starting to get some results, but is also looking for further research on what's happening to our coyote and red foxes.
Yeah, Lee, thanks so much for letting me to talk about this for just a minute. So we've had this project, we've talked about it on this show and Larry Mueller's show prior to this. So we've had a project since 2014 where we have been radio collaring and live trapping red foxes and coyotes in the greater Madison area. And we are moving into a different phase of our research right now, and we are trying to explore the effects of rodenticides, or rat poison, commonly called rat poison. We're looking at the effects of rodenticides on non-target wildlife.
So things other than rodents.
Yeah, so animals that are not being targeted by the rodenticides, that they do ingest the rodenticide. We assume that they're ingesting it through their prey base. So as a coyote or a red fox, for example, goes and catches a mouse after the mouse is eaten at the bait, rodenticide bait, then that coyote or red fox is ingesting the rodenticide through the prey base. But it is possible that they also might be directly ingesting the rodenticide by coming to the bait boxes. And so one of the things we want to do is to put wildlife cameras over bait boxes, over rodenticide baits in Dane and Iowa County. So if you live in Dane or Iowa County and you are using a rodenticide and you would allow us to access your property, we would like to put a wildlife camera over that bait box.
Free of charge?
Free of charge, yep.
Would we be able to see some of the wildlife footage?
Absolutely, 100%. We're going to probably take videos versus pictures, so we'll have video footage. And if you are willing and able to let us do this, if you would email me at ddrake2@wisc.edu. So my name is David Drake. So D is in Delta, D is in Delta, R-A-K-E. The number 2@WISC, the first four letters of Wisconsin.edu. That would be great. We are in no way trying to get rid of rodenticides. We are trying to figure out a safer way to use them. And we will not share your name or location of your property at all. So
you'd remain anonymous.
Yep.
But this would help build data on what's happening with red foxes and coyotes in the Iowa and Dane counties and probably beyond.
Throughout the state and actually anywhere rodenticides are used. And rodenticides are an extremely valuable tool in the toolbox because rodents are such a prolific species, or I'm sorry, prolific type of wildlife. And they breed prodigiously. They do a tremendous amount of damage to agricultural crops, to human health, to other things like that. So rodenticides are a really valuable tool. We're just trying to work with others to figure out how to use them in a safer way, especially safer for non-target wildlife.
It would be great if we could target our rodent control.
Yeah,
I mean, that would be the ideal.
Yep,
and
absolutely.
The more data we can collect in that regard, the better we might be able to get at it eventually.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because we've seen something similar with birds of prey, too, right?
Yeah. I mean, so we'd see that when eagles, hawks, owls, they are showing up with the rodenticide poisoning
David,
as well.
We've been talking about weasels and how they would prey.
They would as well. Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
there's a real secondary concern there about the damage that could be done.
There's been a lot of research done, especially in urban areas, but especially in California. A lot of research done in Europe, some other areas, not so much in the Midwest. So we were anxious to see what our results look like here in the Midwest relative and comparative to other places around the world where rodenticide research has been done and is ongoing.
My takeaway is get a free wildlife cam set up by David Drake by emailing him ddrake2@wisc.edu. It would
be super cool. Yeah, that'd be awesome. Well, thank you so much if you're willing to let us come on, and we'll look forward to hearing from you.
I will look forward to the results and to see what we can do improve what we need to do for pest control while at the same time protecting wildlife.
And absolutely.
It is a balance.
Yep. Thanks, Lee.
Thank you for the research. I love this program, and I can't believe it's already been a dozen years now that you've been doing this work.
I know. It's shocking.
But it also, I mean, I remember seeing this, I think, on PBS. It kind of pulled back the veil for me of how wild something as urban as where we are today, Madison, can be and is.
Yeah, yeah.
That we just don't necessarily see it because they're smart enough not to show us.
Yeah. Well, so or they just do a great job of blending in, adapting to this human-dominated landscape. And there's species that are what we're terming as urban adapted species. You know, we've got sandhill cranes now that are living in Madison. I mean, I live down by Lake Wingriff, you know, where that is in Madison. And there's sandhill cranes. Literally, they walk down the middle of our street on Gregory Street.
They're the new wild turkeys of Wisconsin.
It's wild.
I mean, they've just decided to sort of, we're going to settle here, and they can.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's, you know, we've got badgers on the outskirts of Madison now. So I would suspect that badgers probably are going to be an urban adapted species some point.
Wow.
Yeah, it is super cool. You give wildlife a chance and they will surprise you and amaze you all day long.
Nick and Brule called, couldn't stay with us, but he was wondering about wolverines. He says they are part of the weasel family and wonders, would we find wolverines in Wisconsin?
They are part of the weasel family. Wolverines have not been documented in Wisconsin in decades.
And
they are found in Alaska, and people see them in Alaska and some parts like that, but they've not been here in Wisconsin. Although they are a native species, they've been extirpated from Wisconsin.
Extirpated, pretty much extinct.
Extinct, locally extinct, not extinct throughout their entire range,
All right, let's get to some of the pictures we have now for our guest, David Drake. And you can send us yours at talk@wpr.org. And we'll start with a frog. I know that much.
All right.
Craig from Strum sent us a picture. He says, this blue frog on the edge of a golf course water hazard. His son thought the color was from chemicals used on the course. Turned the frog blue. His granddaughter thought it might be a poisonous frog. The water hazard's about 90 feet by 30 feet. You think this frog will stay in this water hazard? Do they move to other wet areas? He looks for it each time he's near this water hazard, but hasn't seen it again.
Yeah, so I see the picture right here, and I did notice what kind of looked like a bluish tint to the back skin, and I didn't know if that was just the way the picture was taken, but it's interesting that they documented that it actually did have a bluish tint. It looks to me to be a green frog.
It's blue.
It's blue, yes. So it's odd, but it does look like to be a green frog. We can only see the back. If we were going to actually positively identify that, if we could look under the chin, we might see a bright yellow or kind of a whitish chin strap there.
Okay.
But as to why it's blue, that is a good question. I don't know the answer to that question, but I have got some colleagues who work with frogs, and I'm going to ask them as soon as I get back into my department today, and we can maybe report back on the next show.
Golf courses use a lot of fertilizer. They keep those grasses pristine.
They do, but we don't want to throw the golf courses under the bus because they are doing a good job of providing habitat for some species, and as a matter of fact, here in Wisconsin and some of the Midwestern states, our red-headed woodpeckers were declining. And red-headed woodpeckers are typically associated with kind of an oak savanna habitat where you've got more of an open, grassy pasture land with dots of individual trees or kind of clumps of trees here and there. And one of the first places that red-headed woodpeckers started coming back to were golf courses because they replicate oak savannas.
Wow.
Yeah. And so now red-headed woodpeckers are pretty common again.
Craig, thank you for the email. We'll have to follow up with our frog people and get back to you.
Yes, and I promise we will report back on that because it's fascinating.
It's got a blue back for what appears to be a green frog.
Yeah, very interesting.
All right, next picture, and this one is cute. It looks like a teddy bear on a tree. Jay in West Bend emailed us this picture. It's looking right at the camera. He thinks it's a pine martin watching him fish fry up near the boundary waters.
That's a pine
waters.
Martin for
it
sure.
It is!
Yeah, that's super cool. Look at that.
But I don't see the bib on him. Oh, he's just adorable. You kind of want to snuggle.
Yeah, that's pretty cute. That's awesome. Look at that.
So
that's
that is
cool.
So it's near the boundary waters and an actual pine martin. They can climb trees?
Oh, they're excellent tree climbers. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, really
good. But they don't they don't like nest or anything up there, do they? What are they doing in the trees?
Yeah, I believe they're cavity nesters, if I recall.
Oh, so they're finding cavities to crawl
cavities
into?
Cavities to crawl into, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep, they're super cool. Some of the research that... I've got a colleague, John Pauly, who's done a tremendous amount of research on pine martins, and he's actually one of the experts on pine martins here in the state of Wisconsin, if not across North America. But one of the things they do is a lot of molecular research, and so they will pull hairs off of pine martins and then do genetic testing on them or to do isotope analysis to figure out what they're eating and things like that. And one of the ways they catch the hairs is they create these devices that are kind of like a tube, and they adhere them to the tree, and they bait it with, I'm not sure what exactly they bait it with, but the pine martin will kind of climb through that tube, because one of the things about weasels being tubular is that they go into burrows of chipmunks and things like that. Yeah. So they're very comfortable going into these kind of tubular devices. And in there, there's either like barbed wire or something sticky that will actually, as the animal goes through that tube, it will pull hair off the animal, and then you've got a genetic sample. And it's super cool. It's really like efficient way to do some research.
And then you study its genealogy, and then you can sort of like...
figure out maybe what it's eating and you know, where it's going, and figure out like population structures of who's related to who, and it's pretty cool.
As long as we're back on the weasel family in Wisconsin here, let's get to Chris and Stevens Point, who emailed us, wanting to know the status of stone martins in southeastern Wisconsin.
That is a good question, and I don't know the answer to that question.
We didn't talk about stone martins, did we?
No, we have not. So
the American martin is also known as the American pine martin.
Yeah,
those are
I don't know if it's also a stone martin. There are stone martins. I don't know that they're. I believe they're two separate animals, but I should I should look into that and see.
I don't,
I don't know.
It did not come across in any of the, I did a lot of weasel research. We were talking yesterday about what is a weasel and what isn't a weasel, whether a pine martin fits the family. The DNR considers it part of the family.
Oh, pine martins for sure.
And they look a lot alike. Yeah. So since they seem so similar and act so similar that it makes sense that they'd be in the same family.
Yeah. Yep, for sure. But I'll look into that as well and get back to you.
Man, you're giving our guest homework today. I don't know.
Two stumps.
I don't know how I feel
about
that.
I'm going to get fired.
You can't get fired. You don't even work here.
Why not? Another Seinfeld reference. I love it.
David Drake, our guest, he is a specialist at UW Extension and a professor with the Division of Extension and Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology on the UW-Madison campus. If you're looking for his email address again, it is ddrake, D-R-A-K-E, 2@wisc.edu. And you can join our conversation by sending us your pictures at the email talk@wpr.org or calling us over the phone at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And we can get to this next picture here from Todd. He emailed this. Look at
holy cow.
Why would a deer hang his tongue out like this? Could it be EHD? There is EHD in the area, Washington County, and maybe that's what this is. It's okay, so it is a antlered deer. It's what, like a 8.7, 8 point?
Oh, at least, and it's got velvet.
There.
It's in velvet.
What does velvet mean?
So velvet, when they start growing their antlers, velvet is this kind of a skin-like coating that goes over their antlers, and then they'll shed that as they go into rut. And so one of the reasons that deer are that velvet is bringing a lot of blood to the antlers. It's how the antlers grow.
Okay.
And then they'll shed that. It will start to kind of dry out and just kind of fall off the antlers, but then you'll see antler rubs, where they're mm-hmm. rubbing their antlers on, you know, relatively small diameter trees. And one of the reasons they're doing that is to shed that velvet off of their antlers. So this animal's in velvet right now. Beautiful, beautiful rack on that animal.
But it's a younger buck then.
It looks maybe. I mean, it's a good size buck. Not younger. I don't know if it's. It looks like it's a decent sized buck.
Yeah.
But it's probably early in the breeding season, okay. Since it still has velvet on there. And I don't know. Do you know where the picture is taken from?
Well, it sounds like Washington County.
Okay. So yes. So. For the callers who may not be aware, in Washington County, and now I think it's in Osaka and in Waukesha County, EHD has been found in deer. And so EHD is epizootic hemorrhage disease.
Oh, man.
It is a virus that is transmitted to deer by midges, or also called noceums.
Mm-hmm.
And so typically you see EHD in the summer, kind of later summer into the fall, where the midges are starting to really get, you know, very populated. And then once we get a good freeze, usually the first freeze, those midges start dying off, and then EHD kind of falls out of the system or dies off the system. But I think that this EHD was first discovered in Wisconsin in 2002, the same year that chronic wasting disease was. And they've tracked EHD. EHD is not as common up here as it is down in the southern states, just because the midge growing season, the time midges are active, isn't as long up here. But it seems to be more impactful in Wisconsin because the deer likely haven't developed kind of a antibody to it, or tolerance to it. So I think that now they've had the most reported cases of EHD this year in Wisconsin than they have since it's been reported since 2002. And it is possible. So one of the things that happens with EHD is the deer, they look healthy, but they're lethargic. Their tongue is hanging out. Sometimes they'll have a white foam around their mouth or their nose.
It looks actually around the mouth. It looks like there might be some foam.
It does. And then the other issue with deer and when they get EHD is that they tend to become feverish and very dehydrated. So they go to water sources. And a lot of times you'll find dead deer in the water. And it does look like there's a water source there.
Yeah.
So it is. And this is August 22nd is when the date on the picture is. So about a week ago. And so it is possible that that animal is suffering from EHD.
I would say as close as we could get to a diagnosis, that seems the likeliest in this picture with the tongue hanging out. And
especially
with
the location.
Yeah.
So if you suspect deer of suffering from EHD, if you go to the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, they've got a dead and sick wildlife form, online form you can submit. And even though they're not investigating EHD occurrences in areas where they've already found positivity, the DNR still would appreciate the report because it does add to their database.
Todd, the DNR might be interested in this picture.
Yeah,
and,
for sure.
I would think, thank you for sending it along our way, and hopefully we can do some good in that regard. Let's go to Tim in Manitowish Waters next. Hi, Tim.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I wanted to share, last winter, and I'm on a bay between two of the lakes of the Tensane, and right 30 yards in front of my cabin are nine otter, a family of five and a family of four. And I was able to observe them for a half hour plus. But what I didn't notice, neither of the family stepped out to go sniff any of the other families. They always maintained 5 feet apart. Plus,
yeah.
Great fishing in the bay. Plus, it's great fishing.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, so a lot of times the weasel family, the members of the weasel family, are relatively solitary animals. So they will, especially when they're raising young and things like that, they will not necessarily be solitary. But there probably was enough resource there, enough fish, as the caller just said. There's enough food for these animals that they can be there, but they're kind of keeping their distance from each other. And that's a super cool story that you just witnessed.
But if there were a fight over resources, it might be a different scenario for these two otter families.
It could be. And so, either the otters would chase the other otters out of the way. And if they don't, the larger otter is probably going to, at least beat up on the smaller otter, if not maybe potentially kill them, depending on how resource limited that area is. But
I would like to think that the otters could all get along, but I know.
Well, we all get hangry once in a while, you know?
Right, right. All the species get hangry every now and again. Tim, thank you for the story, and I kind of wish I was there with you in Manitowish waters. I appreciate that, and I love the image. Ed Merrill called, couldn't stick around. He wonders if fishers prey on porcupines. Ed's dogs always come back with a few more whiskers after run-ins with porcupines.
Yeah. My parents live up in 70 acres in central Minnesota, and they've had their dogs running with porcupines. And
so
on multiple occasions, my dad holds the dog. My mom pulls the quills out with pliers. You know, and then the dog will do it again, and they don't learn.
Every time.
But yes, your dog, unfortunately, will encounter porcupines if they're in the area. And obviously, porcupines, there are two defense mechanisms. One is to climb a tree, get up in the tree, and get away from the predator or whatever's trying to bother. The other one is the quills. But fishers can kill porcupines. They're one of the few animals that actually can kill porcupines. And the way they do it is on the porcupine face, they have either very few quills or very short quills. And a fisher will just literally badger that porcupine to death on the face, where they'll just beat them to a bloody pulp. And I don't want to get too graphic here, but
the
essentially,
fisher eats the porcupine's face.
Well, so they will beat the porcupine about the face to cause submission. And once they get the animal submitted, then they will roll the porcupine over, and they actually start eating the porcupine from the belly in.
Oh my!
Because
Lord.
On the belly they don't have many quills, and so it's a lot. And the fishers are pretty fierce animals. They're really quick, really fast, so that is one of the few animals that can actually kill and eat a porcupine.
We said nature had it figured out before, but this is a whole other level.
Jeez, that's right.
Ed, yeah. I'm kind of regret you asking, but
so any kids out there who are going for Halloween as a porcupine, if you see a fisher around, take the costume off.
Run. Would you rather have your dog attacked by a porcupine or a skunk? Which one would you think
neither one is good.
No.
I don't know. It's Wednesday. I'm going to go with the skunk today.
A dozen of one.
Yep, and the dogs have been attacked by a skunk, too.
Yeah,
sprayed by a skunk.
A couple of rare sightings this month with a couple minutes we have left. There was a yellow-billed loon that was sighted in Wisconsin for the first time up in Lake Superior. Picture was taken, and then piping plovers were spotted again in Superior for the first time in almost 50 years. A pair of mating piping plovers.
Yeah.
One to me seems we have created the habitat for piping plovers to return, but the yellow-billed loon to me is kind of weird as an Arctic bird that is coming further and further south.
Yeah, well, piping plovers are an federally endangered species of bird. We have a bunch of different plovers in North America. The piping plover is the species that we typically have. They're a shore nesting bird, so they nest on gravelly, sandy areas along lakes. So we've got a population in the Great Lakes, but they're also along the East Coast. They're about the size between a robin and a sparrow, something like that. So a relatively small bird, super cool. But because of habitat loss and disturbance and predation, that they are struggling, in terms of reproduction and recruitment and things like that. But Superior Point on Lake Superior, that when they dredged out the Duluth Harbor, they put a bunch of the dredge material off of Superior Point, the bird area over there. And they started doing this, like, I don't know, 20 years ago, 15 years ago, whatever, and they put the dredge material there specifically to create nesting habitat for piping plover, and they finally used it. And so this is the first time in 49 years that piping plovers have been back on Superior Point. They used to routinely nest there until up to about 1977 or so.
Wow.
So it's a great, awesome example of if you build it, they'll come. And that's really cool.
Eventually.
Yeah, eventually. So that's pretty cool that they do that.
And then the yellow-billed loon.
Yeah, so that's really cool.
Is that just an anomaly?
Yes.
Okay.
So yellow-billed loons, we've got five loon species in the state of in North America. This is the largest of the five. It looks, in the breeding plumage, it looks like our common loon. So it's got black with white dots or whites, on it. But the yellow-billed loon, what color do you think the bill is, Lee?
I'm going to say orange.
Yes, it's yellow. So They've got a yellow bill, and then unlike our common loons that have kind of a rounded head, the yellow-billed loon looks like somebody just whacked it in the head with a mallet and it's got a big knot on the front of its head. And so it looks a little bit similar to our common loon's body shape and coloration. But once you get to the head and the bill, it doesn't look like
pretty
a common loon.
Pretty easy to identify.
Yes. And so a couple people were out fishing in Lake Superior. Apparently they went someplace that they weren't necessarily intending to go and ran into this loon, and one of the people on the boat says, "That doesn't look like a common loon." And
haven't seen one of those before.
And so they nest up in the Arctic. They're in Alaska, up into Canada, and then they will migrate. But they will fly, you know, after the breeding season. Even though the breeding season's still going on, they will tend to wander. And this bird just wandered early and wound up in Lake Superior.
David Drake, we've given you some homework today, so we're looking forward to you handing it in the next time we're able to meet.
I'm on it, Lee.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
David Drake, UW Extension Wildlife Specialist. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you are listening to WPR News.